This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk, and it's presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to once again be in the saddle with you for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today I have the privilege of visiting with a trainer who, throughout his brilliant career, has consistently made the unimaginable appear routine. And when you meet the 71-year-old native of Yorkshire, England, he doesn't appear to be a day over 50. His enthusiasm, his passion for the horse, and for the sport of thoroughbred racing as strong as ever. And since the debut of this show, Trainer Talk, on our network 9 years ago this month, I have had so many trainers join me to share their remarkable stories, from trainers that are just starting out in their careers to household names like Pletcher and Asmussen and Mott. But I can't recall a show where I've welcomed a trainer whose feats have been listed as Guinness World Records. And today's guest didn't establish one world record. He has two. And his win with DeHaas in the 1998 Breeders' Cup Mile at Churchill Downs may very well be the greatest training feat in the history of our sport. And he has one of the greatest nicknames, by the way, ever given to a horse trainer. They call him the Mad Genius. He is Michael Dickinson, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Michael, thanks so much for the visit and for the time.
Thank you for the intro. I don't think we can subject your listeners to 1 hour of me. I think 20 minutes of me is quite long enough.
I have a feeling people will be begging for more when we finish up with that 20 minutes here this afternoon, Michael. But, Mike, do you recall who the first person was to refer to you as the Mad Genius?
Yes, it was Steve Haskin from the Daily Racing Form.
Do you like the nickname?
Yeah, it's all right. Yes, it's only half true.
Well, whether it's the mad part or the genius part, we don't know. But I have a feeling that a lot of people will say it's the genius part, Michael, because your career has been remarkable. Why don't we start in the beginning? Take me back to the beginning, growing up in England, being born to a racing family. Tell me more about that.
Yes, I'm a third-generation horseman, and I chose my parents well because they were both good horsemen. My mother was represented England show jumping. She was a very good trainer and the leading point-to-point rider of her time. So she excelled in three different disciplines. My father was a good horseman, too.
As you were growing up and you were watching your parents around the horses, did you know right away that this is what you wanted to do?
I think it's the only thing I could do. I don't think I would have made a nuclear scientist.
Did your parents encourage you to follow in their footsteps?
Yes. There was never a plan B.
Yeah, pretty remarkable stuff. And to see where it's ended up today is pretty incredible. What was your first job on the racetrack?
Well,
your first official job?
I'm only a farm boy from Maryland.
Okay.
But I've been lucky enough to have a good lifetime's experience around the world. I was 11 years of a steeplechase rider in the UK, which was the most fun. 4 years as a steeplechase trainer in the UK. 1 year training on the flat for Robert Sangster in the UK. And 8 years training at Fair Hill, which I loved. Fair Hill's a great training center. And 8 years training at Topeka Farm, which was terrific. And 8 years with Topeka Footings when I went to 14 countries. And you won't believe this, my wife even sent me to Syria. Thought there might be interest in the track. Maybe she was trying to get me done in. Then I had 20 weeks in Australia and 2 weeks in the UAE. So as the I'm stealing a line from the Farmers Insurance advert, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
Well, there's certainly no doubt about that. Let's talk about that riding career for just a little bit. You know, you mentioned the steeplechase riding,
yes,
the steeplechase
training.
Yes, I love
steeplechasing.
Yeah.
Yes, it was terrific. My mother told me when I was very young that steeplechase jockeys had to be brave, and they do. About 1 in 14 is a fall, and they have to be. And I wasn't very brave, but I cheated a little bit because I put a lot of time and effort into the schooling and teaching of them. So I built my own hurdles and steeplechase fences, put a lot of time into that and treading in the divots. So when my horses ran, they were all good jumpers. So I should have been brave, but I wasn't brave. But yes, but it survived me all right. I had 378 winners and I had a great time steeplechasing. I was always very grateful for the horses for taking me over those fences.
Yeah, I've often asked trainers who have taken that same path that you have, and I've asked them, why would anybody want to ride over jumps? Because it just, from the outside looking in, Michael, it seems so dangerous.
Well, it's not really dangerous. I mean, I rode for 11 years. I only had two fairly bad falls, and that's when people behind me galloped over me. Hitting the ground really wasn't usually a problem. So, I think it's fairly dangerous riding flat racing in America because they're going so fast, the ground's so hard, it comes so sudden. To be honest with you, I think I'd sooner be a steeplechase jockey than I would be a flat jockey in America.
Yeah, interesting. Very, very interesting. What are some of the greatest memories you have of some of the horses you rode?
Well, I wasn't much good in a finish. If I was perhaps being a little bit kind, I was quite good over a fence, steeplechase fence. And my goal was to gain a length or two at as many fences as possible in a race, and that would win me the race. So it was when I got those jumps when I would gain a length or two in the air. That was great.
You can actually gain a length or two going over a jump?
Oh, yes, absolutely. An English steeplechase fence, you can. If you just meet it right and ping, yes, they can. Yep, definitely.
Wow, incredible.
And I've got that on tape, so... our fences are a little bit bigger than the American ones, so there's more potential there, and that was great.
Tell me about making the transition from riding steeplechase races to then training.
I had a bad accident when I was 29. It wasn't a bad fall, it was just a horse galloped over me. I had a split liver and a bruised heart, so that was that. But I enjoyed that. I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Well, how did you first get introduced to the training side of things when you stopped riding?
Oh, well, my father was a trainer.
Yep.
But when I was still riding, you asked me who was the most influential person on my career, and it was Vincent O'Brien, who trained at Ballydoyle. He won the Derby 6 times on all the big races, including the Breeders' Cup, and he won 100 great grade ones, group ones. Fantastic trainer. So I went to work for him in the summer during the closed season. And the first day I went to Ballydoyle, as a horseman, this was just heaven. If I'd seen the Niagara Falls, the Great Wall of China, and the pyramids all on the same day, it could not have had more effect on me than it did looking around Ballydoyle. They've got 500 acres in Tipperary, some fantastic all-weather gallops, and some fantastic turf gallops. And it was just so well run. And it's the two happiest times of my life when I was there at Ballydoyle in the summer there. And I rode some super horses. I rode several Group 1 winners. I rode 2 champion sprinters. Appalachie was a champion 2-year-old and about 4 more. So fantastic experience for a 25-year-old. So he was the biggest influence on my life. So when I came to America, I wanted to build Ballydoyle in America. And I did. I got Vincent's head man. He spent 4 summers with me selecting the farm and then helping me build it. He was called Johnny Brabston, and he used to ride Nijinsky and Sadler's Wells.
Okay.
And he was a big help. So that's how we started to Peter Farm. the Peter Farm is not as big as Ballydoyle. We're only 200 acres, but it's got terrific facilities.
What was it about Vincent O'Brien that made him such a good trainer?
Okay, right. Good point. Well, everything was just about perfect. He was a big man on surfaces. If he was buying million-dollar yearlings, well, people aren't going to send you a million-dollar yearling if you think you're going to break it down. And he had fantastic. He was the person who invented the modern all-weather gallop 45 years ago. And
wow.
We're still messing around with those now. He was way ahead of his time, had great surfaces. And Johnny worked for him for 28 years, and they only had two fatalities in 28 years. Now, supposing his memory is not as good as it was, then it was four fatalities. It's still fantastic. So we had good riders, the great surfaces to train them on, and he was an excellent judge of a yearling himself.
Yeah, simply incredible. And to take that concept and bring it to the United States is something you have to be very, very proud of, Michael.
You mean the all-weathers?
Yeah, the all-weathers, the Ballydoyle concept that you tried to create.
I'm
you
proud
have to
of
be
the
proud.
Farm.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm 71, I'm 72, so at the end of next season, I'm going to sell it. I don't know who will buy it, but it's 200 acres on the north end of the Chesapeake Bay. It's a great location because we're surrounded by 11 racetracks. Obviously, mm-hmm. got Belmont and Aqueduct, but Monmouth, Delaware Park, Pimlico, Laurel, and about seven more. So it's a great location. I've got two all-weather tracks and six turf tracks, and without fear of contradiction, my turf tracks are the best in America. I just have great passion for them. And this is a good facility for somebody.
Yeah, I would say so. Talking with Michael Dickinson here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Michael, I asked you about Vincent O'Brien and what made him so good. What is the Michael Dickinson philosophy and approach to training racehorses?
Not to make mistakes. We never, ever say, oh, we did well, or we're brilliant. We never, ever do that. But just at the end of the day, we suddenly say, look, we shouldn't have done that. So it's just making fewest mistakes. It's nothing about brilliance. It's just not messing up. I'm a big believer in Mark Johnson, who's one of the leading trainers in England. And his philosophy is you've got to train him to eat. If you want to go to the moon, you've got to have rocket fuel. And his horses always look well. So our horses eat a lot. They're on about 18 pounds of grain a day.
Okay.
And we're big believers in turning out in the field. I don't mean that if you're not careful, a paddock can be mud, weeds, and parasites. But we have 50 acres of turnout. But we always have fresh green grass. So the four reasons we turn out, starting at the top, the head, keep them relaxed. That's a no-brainer for 3 hours in a field. Number two, fresh air for the lungs. That's fairly common sense. Number three is grass for the stomach. As we know, most horses in training get stomach ulcers. And grass is the best remedy and prevention for that. Much as we all like a steak, we like a salad to go with it. And the horses love the grass. And the other thing, by moving around, the horses, it includes a colloidal structure, and it keeps them sounder. The horse spent a lot of time in the field because he was always coming up stiff in the morning, and it used to loosen him up.
Very interesting. Yeah, it's a great philosophy and a great approach to keeping the horse healthy and happy, and then getting them to perform their best. It makes so much sense. If you can keep them happy and healthy, they'll do what you need them to do in the afternoons, right?
Yes. We had another horse that had been with four trainers, and he was a claimer. I'm not going to tell you his name because I don't want to embarrass anyone, but then he went on and won two grade ones and $1 million. It wasn't the horse, by the way. And that's just because he came to the farm. He used to love going out in the field, and he used to love training up the hills. He didn't really used to like training. We used to love going up the hills. So we got him fit up the hills, and we kept him happy in the field. So I went from a claimer to $1 million.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. You mentioned the name DeHaas, and I mentioned him at the top of the show. Tell me a little bit more about DeHaas when you think back on him and his career.
Well, okay, yeah. I didn't have a lot to do with him, actually. It was my wife loved him more than me, I'd say. Miguel Piedra, our barn foreman, looked after him, and John Boy rode him. John Boy was excellent, right? He would always get the breeze within a fifth of a second, and he knew him when he was right. The hardest bit about him was he used to love to train, but he had all sorts of aches and pains as he, by the time he was five. He'd had, as a foal, he lost half his foot, and as a two-year-old, he had developed bone spurs on his hocks. And they were okay when he was three, but when he got to four or five, they became a problem. And so he'd come out a bit stiff. But even he always wanted to give them hell, even when he wasn't right. So we had to stop him doing too much, especially when he wasn't right. If he wasn't right, we'd just pull him up.
Okay.
In the breeze, if he's not moving right. So it was to stop him doing too much, because he wanted to give them hell every day.
When he won that first Breeders' Cup mile in 1996. Tell me about that day. What do you remember?
Woodbine. Well, okay. He liked firm going. And my wife was up there for 10 days before the race and said, she'd speak every night. She said, it's raining. I said, I don't want to hear that. So it had rained for 10 days. So I got there on the Wednesday and it was a bit soft. I said, well, we're not going to win the race on this. So the three of us, that's John Boy's exercise rider, John and myself, walked round, and we walked around three times because we thought there was maybe one dry strip down the back and maybe another dry strip up the home stretch. And this was the high heel story, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I had my pentrometer and John Boy had a stick and Joan was there. And we thought we had this trick. I said, Joan, go and get some high heels. Just going back. When I was a steeplechase rider, I was dating a model. And she came racing with me in a cocktail dress and high heels, which is not what you normally go steeplechasing in, but never mind. So I said, I'm going to walk the course. So bless her, she said, yes, I'll come with you. So she walked around 2 miles in soft going in high heels. And I said, I'm going to come up the left-hand side. Oh, she says, don't. My heel's going much more on the left. Go on the right. So by accident, I discovered one way of testing a turf track was high heels. So we were fast forward 25 years. We're at Woodbine. So Joan was dispatched to the nearest shoe barn, pair of cheap high heels, and we walked the track. And it was, there was a dry strip up the home, up the backside, not the home stretch. So, you know, Gary Stevens rode the horse, and they interviewed him afterwards, and he said the going was good. And they interviewed the favorite, who said the going was soft. And, of course, they were both right, because where the favorite was soft, and where Gary was good. So that was our first Breeders' Cup.
Oh, what a great story. And then 2 years later, he comes back. He wins at Churchill Downs. Tom Durkin with that great call, the greatest comeback since Lazarus. I was there that day, Michael, and I can remember how electric that crowd was as he was storming down the stretch. Take me back to 1998. You come into that race off of the injuries and the long layoff. Tell me about that one.
Well, we thought he would win. And Gary saw my boys at the press conference on Thursday, the press dinner, whatever it's called. And they all told him, Gary, you messed up. Because he got off him, you see, to ride something else.
Yeah.
So that's how we put Johnny on. So they told him, Gary, you messed up. Because what had happened, at the it hadn't run for a year, as you know. So back in February of 98, I call up Ron Anderson, Gary's agent, said, you are riding for me, DeHaas, in the Breeders' Cup. Yep. So the first of every month, March, April, May, June, July, I'd call him up. You're riding for me, Breeders' Cup. Don't forget, DeHaas will be there. So it came to 2 weeks before the race. I said, you're riding for me, aren't you? No, I'm not. This is Ron Anderson, who is a very good agent, as you know.
Yeah.
Very smart.
Yeah.
So I said, you're riding for me? No, I'm not. I'm riding among men. This is Michael Stoughton-Tabor. I said, among men? You must be joking. Among men against a horse? So I said, I'll bet you $1,000. Wherever they finish, whether the first and second or last and next to last, we'll finish in front of among men. So he took me on, and he paid me right away because he's a gentleman. And 999 times he would have been right. If you hadn't had a horse run for 2 years, he's not going to win the Breeders' Cup, is he?
Right.
So that was that.
Wow, pretty incredible. Do you view that,
sorry?
Michael? Does Michael Dickinson view that as one of the greatest feats in racing history, training feats?
No, I just had the best horse.
Yeah.
It's easy winning when you got the best horse.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was that day. As I was getting ready for the program, I watched the race again. Do you ever go back and watch the replay of that race?
Yes, once or twice.
Sure.
Yeah, that was good.
There have been so many other top horses that have come through your care. One that stands out to me is Tappet, and people will forget that he was with you. He won the Wood Memorial. He took you to the Kentucky Derby, the only time that you've been there. Tell me a little bit more about Tappet.
Well, we've no idea how good Tappet might have been. He won a graded stake as a two-year-old, great. And first time out as a three-year-old, ran in the Florida Derby, and he stopped ahead of the stretch there, and we scoped him. He was full. He was training in Florida for the winter, full of thick, cheesy mucus, horrible stuff. So I brought him home, gave him a little bit of a rest, and then Mr. Winchell wanted to run in the wood. I said, well, he's not going to be ready. So anyhow, David Fisk came, and he breezed 5 furlongs in 103, which, you know, isn't very fast. I said, well, he's not right. But Ron wanted him to win to try and make him a Group 1 winner, then it made him a stallion. So I thought he'd finish last. Whenever you run a horse, which you shouldn't have run, you always finish last, and that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a great wood, and Tappet was a very brave horse and very classy, and he won it despite being sick. And all he did from the winner's circle to the spit box was cough, and he was just full of blood and mucus.
Wow.
Outstanding. I mean, you know, I've never had a horse like that. He was so good. I mean, just think how good he would have been if he'd been healthy.
Yeah.
And he never got over that, wiped him out. And that's the way of the world.
Yeah. What was the first Kentucky Derby experience like for you when he went to the Derby in his next start?
Well, finishing ninth sucks.
Yeah.
It might be the Kentucky Derby, but it's you know, we finished ninth. So... yeah.
To see his success as a stallion now, Michael, how proud are you of what he's done as a stallion?
Yeah, yep. Yeah. We thought he'd be very good. Perhaps we didn't think he was going to be as good as he was. And he had a great pedigree. And we just didn't know how good he would have been.
Yeah. Yeah, he was certainly brilliant. When you stepped away from training in 2007 to focus on your Tapeta footing surfaces, you came back in 2016. That time period when you were doing that, was it difficult to be away from training?
No. My wife had helped me a lot with the training, and she wanted to do this. So we went together. No, I enjoyed it. I mean, I went to 14 countries, had a great time. Wherever we were well looked after. It was terrific. I couldn't say one country's better than another because they're all good.
Yeah.
And it was a tremendous experience. I was working with some of the top trainers in the world. And we had a great time.
The surface, Tapeta, is considered to be the premier synthetic surface in the sport. In the United States, it was installed at some tracks. Some kept it, some didn't. You know, obviously, Woodbine has the Tapeta surface. They love it. What is it about that surface, yes, Michael, that just makes it so
right.
good?
Okay, well, I developed the first Tapeta tracks.
Yeah.
And it took me 4 years and 52 different samples. And they were okay. Golden Gate was one of the first ones we did in Presque Isle, and they were okay. My wife came along and said, I can do better, as wives do. So I said, well, you better know more about sand fibers, wax, and polymers than anyone else. So she really studied hard. And down in her lab there are 200 samples that she's tried. I call them failures. She called them tests. And as you know, when you're doing research, if one out of 20 is a success, that's great. So she came out with Tapeter 10 because she made 10 improvements on my formula. So the new ones are much better.
Okay.
And our big success story has been Newcastle in England. They tore up a turf track there, and it was an uproar from all the top trainers. Oh, we'll never run there again. And now they love it. And Royal Ascot, they have 30 races at Royal Ascot, and 13 of the winners came off Newcastle. Unbelievable. We've got 60 racetracks in England.
Wow.
And, it prepped them for Royal Ascot. And now it's very popular.
Well, Michael, it's been quite a ride, and I told you I wouldn't keep you very long on this program here today, but it's been such a delight to hear your story. There are so many other stories I know we could tell, but I know you have things to get to, so I won't keep you, and really do appreciate the visit. It's been, like I say, it's been a delight to hear your story and to look back on some of those top moments in your career. Great to see you back training again, and I know there's going to be many more to come.
Okay, thank you very much.
Michael, appreciate it. Michael Dickinson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. And, what a career. And I mentioned at the top of the show, we didn't get time to talk about it because Michael had to go, but I mentioned at the top of the show that he is the holder of 2 Guinness World Records. He trained a record 12 winners, get this, in a single day, December 26, 1982. That was on Boxing Day. And then he came back and trained the first 5 finishers of the 1983 Cheltenham Gold Cup, which is just remarkable. Both of those Guinness World Records. And again, I wish I had more time to spend with him. There was so much that we could have talked about, so many more things. But you can tell he's a really smart guy, really smart trainer, and always puts the interest of the horse first. So my thanks to Michael Dickinson for being with me on this edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Back with a brand new edition of the show coming up next week here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, for Michael Dickinson, my special guest, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Nominations are still open for the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell? Consistent success tested over time. There is no better example than Millridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as Pillar of the Turf. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 36 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year. Millridge offers its largest and highest quality consignment ever at this year's Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, with 9 yearlings by leading stallions and promising first-year sires. And will be showing at Barn 5 on Friday, August 6th. Millridge, standing the test of time.